Hello, and welcome to Off the Shelf, Festival of Words. In this Ideas Alive episode, Professor Beth Perry, Director of the Urban Institute, explores the challenges and opportunities for academics in contributing to positive urban transformations.
April 2019. The sun beat down on us whilst we gathered on plastic chairs at the base of the rocks. We listened to the elder men narrate the history of Abindu Caves in Kisumu County, Kenya, before showing us the carvings, caves and small holdings that surround the site. Full of secrets, myths and legends, we left to continue our tour of sacred and cultural sites in Kisumu. 3 years later, I am back in Kisumu, this time at Dunga Beach. Dunga Beach is a fishing and tourism destination, 5 kilometres from the central business district of Kisumu, a peninsula on the shores of Lake Victoria, dominated by rocky surfaces, wetlands, hills, cliffs and springs. Footpaths, murram and tarmac-covered roads lead to mud-walled houses made of stones and soil, alongside permanent houses made of bricks and blocks with iron roofs. The site consists of residential, commercial and recreation buildings, with a boardwalk leading to the lake shore made of timber with an iron roof. The pier forms a docking area for fishing boats and tour boats, which stretch into Lake Victoria. The area is a fish breeding ground, where hippos have also roamed freely, while the lake is used for kayaking and sport fishing. Dunga is recognised as a cultural heritage site by the national government, through the National Museums of Kenya, and by the Kisumu County Government since the devolution of cultural heritage responsibilities in 2010. Dunga Wetland is also marketed as an important bird area by Nature Kenya and BirdLife International. There are over 800 bird species, including threatened species such as Papyrus gonalec, white-winged warbler and the Papyrus canary. Community management is well established at Dunga Beach, where a beach management unit was founded in 1997 by an Act of Parliament calling for the formation of such units along the lakes and oceans in Kenya. The community-based organisation, DECTA, Dunga Ecotourism and Environment Community Tourism Association, was created after formal recognition of the site as heritage in 2003. Kisumu boasts many such diverse cultural heritage resources that are uniquely and spatially distributed on the landscape. How such resources can be mobilised in support of wider development goals, including poverty reduction and economic growth, whilst protecting natural and cultural heritage, are key concerns. This is particularly important as local people around cultural and sacred sites have sought to secure their livelihoods through unsustainable practices such as quarrying, deforestation or sand harvesting. Environmental challenges include indiscriminate bush and vegetation clearances for agriculture and over-extraction of natural resources for fuel, medicine or building materials. In October 2022, I am back sitting in the office of DECTA. I'm here to see what difference our research has made to the effective organisation and management at the site, and how they can put ecotourism into practice. The group are supportive of working with academics. The Dunga representatives, made up largely of tour guides, boat operators and fishermen, tell us that our new research report, looking at the roles of community-based organisations in managing different cultural heritage values and supporting vibrant and sustainable ecotourism, will help them promote their sites and leverage the support of the county government. I'm Professor Beth Perry, Director at the Urban Institute, University of Sheffield. My research has focused on the relationships between universities, academics, and communities, and how research can support fairer, greener, and more diverse urban futures. I am one of many researchers committed to mobilising research to contribute to more positive urban transformations in cities and communities in the UK and around the world. This is an agenda of international appeal. In Kenya, Dr. Franklin Awuor told me about the Kenyan government's strategy over the past decade to both build up new universities in the devolved counties and expand and improve existing ones. The aim is to see them become motors of economic growth. There is some evidence behind this aspiration. Universities UK, a member organisation of 140 universities across the UK, commissioned research from Frontier Economics in 2021 that estimated English universities contribute £95 billion to the economy and support more than 800,000 jobs. Their research report also highlighted that the higher education sector in England has grown by around a quarter over 5 years in terms of gross domestic product to over £50 billion. Since the 2000s, my work has examined how universities in the UK have become more involved in strategies to drive what's called the knowledge economy through initiatives such as science cities or knowledge capitals. In 1997, during his election campaign, Tony Blair famously prioritised education, education, education as a key policy plank in his manifesto. This included an ambitious goal to widen participation in universities to 50% of the population. Studies since then have focused on the contributions of universities to their local economies in terms of the spending power of students, employment generation, and jobs created. The figures are impressive. Places with universities do tend to be wealthier. One US Senator, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, is attributed with saying, "If you want to build a great city, create a great university and wait 200 years. But these claims need closer inspection. In my book, written with Professor Tim May, visiting professor at Cardiff University, we critically analysed these developments. The book, called Cities and the Knowledge Economy, Promise, Politics and Possibility, highlighted the danger of building a knowledge economy for the few, not the many. Against the backdrop of a movement from manufacturing to service economies, the knowledge economy has become a mobilising image for cities to create opportunities for their futures. Its promise rests upon the concentration of services and economies of scale through generating a critical mass of expertise intended to lead to innovation and wealth creation. Yet we argue that the promise of the knowledge economy cannot provide a recipe for success in an uncertain world. What is the overall purpose of the knowledge-based economy? Is it to enhance democratic aspirations by bringing political control closer to urban citizens? Or a technocratic fix to enhance the efficiency of urban political apparatuses to pursue particular economic agendas? Who wins and who loses? Over the past 20 years, universities have increasingly become part of what academics John Logan and Harvey Mollux have called growth coalitions for the knowledge economy. We argue that the assumed benefits of having a university in a city exemplify trickle-down economics, which characterises the knowledge economy. This term was originally coined in the 1930s to capture the idea that giving economic help to those at the top of society would generate positive outcomes for others. But researchers, including ourselves, have been deeply critical of these developments. Questions have been raised about the extent that people from poorer backgrounds with adverse childhood experiences have the opportunity to go to university, about who gets the jobs that are created, or whether the knowledge economy just sees local communities relegated to serving coffee to students in overpriced cafes or pushed out of their own neighbourhoods to build student accommodation in prime city centre locations. This debate about the relationship between universities and community is not new. In medieval Cambridge, students were often unable to speak the local dialect and conversed in Latin, alienating many local people. It is said that Cambridge was founded by academics fleeing Oxford after three Oxford scholars were hanged for the death of a woman, and a series of confrontations with townsfolk resulted. Some reports claim that 63 people died that day. Fast forward nearly 700 years, and it is fair to say such disputes are less deadly, but nonetheless traumatic for locals involved. In St Andrews, Scotland, since the 1990s, the number of students has doubled to 9,000, whilst the resident population has shrunk by 40% to around 7,000. This has prompted one local councillor to describe the displacement of permanent residents by students as a kind of social cleansing, whilst another feared that if it carries on like this, we're not going to have a town left. And it's not only about student housing. One resident in South Manchester told the Guardian newspaper, "At the beginning of the academic year, there are new business cards dropped all over the area with someone's first name, a number, and a little sample of cannabis on them so you can call the dealer. My kids have been offered drugs from the age of 14. Over the past 10 years, universities have sought to mitigate these effects and develop community engagement strategies. A different narrative to the knowledge economy has begun to develop. In March 2020, the Civic University Network was formed, following a Civic University Commission chaired by Lord Kerslake, to examine the economic, social, environmental and cultural roles universities play in building places. The Commission's final report, Truly Civic, Strengthening the Connection Between Universities and Their Places, concluded that whilst universities are civically engaged, they are rarely civic universities. There is a long way to go. In his foreword, Lord Kerslake wrote that, "We found few examples of a systematic and strategic approach to the civic role, based on an analysis of the needs of the place. Our proposal that universities need to do this if they want to go beyond civic engagement to become truly civic universities forms a central recommendation of the report." Part of the problem is that universities have focused on what they can do as strategic actors, as businesses, as landowners. But what makes a university distinctive from, for example, a hospital in this respect? The distinctiveness of the university is the knowledge that it produces and disseminates through teaching to students, communication with society, and the impact that it has. In my work, frustrated with the limits of organisational responses to increasing urban challenges, I started looking at what roles engaged academics could play in mobilising their research to contribute to positive urban transformations for local communities. Knowledge is, as famed sociologist Michel Foucault has said, intrinsically linked to power. Foucault argued that every educational system is a political means of maintaining or modifying the appropriation of discourse. Truth is then linked in a circular relation with systems of power which produce and sustain it. Whilst Foucault focused on knowledge and power, pragmatists have emphasised knowledge and action. There is a long tradition of pragmatism that has particularly prioritised these relations. In a special issue of the journal Methodological Innovations Online, which we published in 2022, our colleague at Manchester University, Dr. Dan Silver, looked at the legacy and work of W.E.B. Du Bois, an influential Black American sociologist in the early 20th century, whose work challenges us to think about how social science can support social transformation. Du Bois was particularly vehement that if social science sought to copy the natural sciences, it ran the risk of legitimising the oppression of minorities. How could one stay calm, cool, and detached, he argued, when black people were being lynched and murdered? Du Bois developed a critique outlining the negativity of black oppression and slavery. But he did not stop there. Rather, he proposed what could go in its place. This gave rise to sets of ideas and actions that continue to shape the abolitionist movement today. Whilst some scientists have traditionally believed that knowledge must be produced in laboratory-like conditions to control for variables and isolate causes, studies of society cannot follow this model. Social science must take seriously our belonging and position as academics in the world, and think about how knowledge is produced together with others and for what purposes. There are many examples at Sheffield University of academics seeking to play a positive role in urban transformations, drawing on strong traditions of engaged scholarship and research. Over 6,000 miles from Kisumu, my research also involves working with Arbuthorne Community Primary School in Sheffield. Arbuthorne Community Primary School is part of the Park and Arbuthorne Ward in the city of Sheffield. Since 2010, austerity policies have had a huge impact on the neighbourhood. People have spoken of the community pulling apart, leading to high levels of social isolation and loneliness, and a weakening of social ties between groups and different organisations. Key statistics paint a picture of a community struggling to make ends meet. According to indices of multiple deprivation data, the ward is the fifth poorest in the city and has had a high percentage of economically inactive citizens, with low indicators on health and well-being and high levels of crime compared with other areas of the city. Life expectancy for men is up to 20 years lower than elsewhere in Sheffield, and 26% of residents have no qualifications. These are some of the reasons behind a new partnership called An Even Better Arbuthorne between the school and the Council for Innovation in Voluntary Action, with funding from the National Lottery Community Fund and the Tudor Trust. An Even Better Arbuthorne is a project based at Arbuthorne Community Primary School, which aims to address the root causes of hardship by bringing new ideas and solutions into the community. The approach of An Even Better Arbuthorne is to support community capacity building and poverty reduction through engaging with families and community organisations through the school. The focus to date has been on volunteering through school-based initiatives to encourage active citizenship and entrepreneurship to make Arbuthorne even better whilst celebrating what already exists. This has involved improving the physical infrastructure of the school to benefit the community, for instance, through building a polytunnel, growing area, and outdoor classroom for community use, and setting up the first school-based community fridge. As well as reducing food waste and food poverty, An Even Better Arbuthorne helps members of the community overcome social isolation and improve their mental health. At the heart of the initiative is a volunteer programme. The bulk of volunteers are parents and community members. The volunteer coordinator told me, "The people who volunteer the most are often the most vulnerable and need more encouragement to grow and more confidence building, more reassurance." Volunteering has enabled people to have a sense of control over their own lives, boosted confidence and self-efficacy, and provided positive role modelling to children. I was involved delivering a learning programme for An Even Better Arbuthorne, researching how the volunteer programme could be more effective and planning for the future. The volunteer coordinator reported that the university's learning programme has made a huge difference to the volunteers. It has created a culture of openness and clarity and given them a safe space to voice their thoughts and feelings. Beyond my work, a central part of an Even Better Arbourthorne has been innovative partnerships to support the initiative, including with the University of Sheffield. Partnership with the Urban Institute catalysed a Women's Savers initiative. Savings-based organising is an approach tried and tested by Slum Shack Dwellers International over more than 20 years in the Global South. People on low incomes save a little of what they have each week whilst also working together to attract investment into their community. Arbourthorne Social Savers was catalysed by Dr. Sophie King whilst working on research looking at the value of savings approaches from the Global South for women in low-income communities in the UK. Following a visit to Withenshaw in Manchester to meet with a women-led network called Community Savers, Arbourthorne volunteers decided to set up their own group. They applied for some initial funds from an Even Better Arbourthorne to get going, but are now independent members of the savings movement supported by community-led savings and action support. Beyond the Urban Institute, the School of Education, Architecture, Medicine, and Urban Studies and Planning have also been involved with supporting the school's vision to provide physical and social community infrastructure. The school developed a partnership with the School of Education at the University of Sheffield to design and deliver a Maker programme, spearheaded by Dr. Alison Buxton. Arbourthorne Community Primary School has been awarded the status of being the first Maker school in Sheffield. Here is what Vanessa Langley, head teacher of the school, had to say about the university partnership. The work from the architecture students to build a polytunnel, fire pit, an outdoor learning environment produces a manageable, visible impact for schools and for children and for families. And the work with the medics is driving up our focus on health and nutrition. These are some clear examples of how academics at Sheffield University are seeking to contribute to positive urban transformations. But it does not stop at our doorstep. My colleague, Professor Vanessa Castan-Broto, for example, is delivering a world-leading programme of work on climate urbanism, which includes working with decision makers in Mozambique to incorporate gender diversity and intersectional concerns within their policies, and supporting community energy projects in cities around the world. In my recent published work, I have explored some of the critical implications of the renewed movement for engaged urban scholarship and research. First, it is important to do research with people, not on them, if we want to contribute to long-lasting change. The idea of co-production captures this principle and involves acknowledging that academics are not the only ones that can or should produce knowledge that matters. Citizens, professionals, and decision makers all have expertise that can help think through how to understand some of the urgent, complex urban challenges we face and how those challenges might be addressed in practice. Increasingly, academics such as myself are co-producing research with others in society. The hope is that this is both a more open and inclusive way to produce knowledge, but that it will also produce greater impact by directly involving people affected by research in its production. Co-production is the latest concept building on the traditions of critical thought and pragmatism that alters how we see the roles of academics. Not as distanced, impartial commentators from within their ivory towers, but as critical friends who can form alliances and develop allyship with individuals and organisations within urban areas and cities who are committed to urban justice. Second, this means holding on to the distinctiveness of academic expertise through our approach, methods, and analysis. This means retaining a critical disposition. After all, who is to say what is a positive urban transformation? There are competing and contested knowledge claims that need to be negotiated. In my work, I have looked at the different strategies and tactics that academics might use to intermediate between different ideas of what makes a positive urban transformation, how it might be brought about, and whose interests are served. Often, this involves bringing people together to produce knowledge themselves. The purpose of knowledge is not always to resolve or settle. Our role is not the same as that, for instance, of consultants in providing solutions to preconceived questions. Instead, knowledge should open up and challenge, and that means staying critical and engaged. Here, critique is not a totalising gaze that provides closure, but an invitation. Critique needs to be imminent and caught up with the movements and processes in which it is entangled. This takes not distance as a precondition for research, but instead our very embeddedness in the social world. Third, universities are not well geared up to support academics committed to engaged scholarship. Increasingly, universities talk about their third mission of impact, community engagement, and outreach. But this is less well funded or resourced than either teaching or traditional research, and often still emphasises a narrow economic instrumentality in which spin-off companies are valued more than local capacity building with communities. Engaged research is not always good for people's careers, particularly early career researchers. Universities still reward traditional academic publications judged by peer review or the levels of grant income received more than the social impact of research. Their budgets far exceed that of any community organisation, even whilst the sector is characterised by precarity, underrepresentation of black and ethnic minority scholars, and unequal pay, for instance. These challenges shape our research partnerships internationally as well. Global research funding still tends to prioritise the exportation of Western expertise over valuing local or indigenous knowledge. Funding tends to support northern academics to extract research from lower and middle income countries. The challenge is therefore global, to create the conditions within universities and systems of research funding and higher education to support engaged academics and build alliances that take the relations between knowledge and action seriously. For some universities, this necessitates fundamental shifts. For others, it is a return to roots. The University of Sheffield developed from three local institutions, the Sheffield School of Medicine, Firth College, and the Sheffield Technical School. When the university asked the people of Sheffield for donations in 1904, Sheffield responded. Over £50,000 was raised by penny donations from local steel and factory workers and residents, equivalent to over £15 million in today's money. Thanks to Sheffielders' generosity, the university was able to establish a world-class institution. At the Urban Institute, staff are motivated by concern that current trajectories and pathways shaping future cities are unsustainable and risk reproducing inequalities which marginalise urban inhabitants around the world. Our work spans critical theory development and applied action-based interventions, with a commitment to learn from the past, understand the present, and imagine alternative futures. We need novel or disruptive propositions that change how we think about cities. This means that opening up and challenging existing policies is as valuable as finding solutions that relieve decision makers of the need to think differently. In the midst of spiralling ecological devastation, feminist theorist Donna Haraway argues that learning to stay with the trouble of living and dying together on a damaged earth will prove more conducive to the kind of thinking that would provide the means to building more livable futures. This idea of staying with the trouble has been a call to action for many engaged academics. Contributing to positive urban transformations is difficult, particularly within institutions that do not always value such work in practice. Staying with the trouble is precisely what we must do if we are to contribute effectively to more sustainable and just urban futures.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the festival, please visit www.offtheshelf.org.uk. We'd love to hear your thoughts and responses on social media. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.